This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Now Iran is messing with U.S. elections. Fake emails get sent to American voters. How deep does this all go?
Well, that is one of those questions to which we don't really know the answer.
Also today, Germany's push to get off dirty coal. The trick? Sell the alternatives.
To say this is a change to something else that could be good, something else that for some people could be better.
And in Nigeria, a violent police crackdown. Nigerians across the globe are amplifying the anger in Lagos.
Do you want people in Nigeria to know that just because we're not there doesn't mean that we don't care? And that's an important message to send.
And that art in the museum, real or fake? The curator knows for sure. I'm Marco Werman. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. With less than 2 weeks until Election Day, the U.S. intelligence community issued a warning. Foreign powers are trying to influence the vote. Here's Director of National Intelligence John Ratcliffe last night.
We have identified that two foreign actors, Iran and Russia, have taken specific actions to influence public opinion relating to our elections.
Ratcliffe said Iran obtained American voter registration data and has been sending threatening faked emails to American voters. The Iranian government denies the allegation, and it has summoned the Swiss envoy in Tehran to condemn what it calls baseless accusations of meddling in the U.S. election. John Scott Railton joins us now. He's a senior researcher at the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto, which focuses on technological threats to civil society. First of all, John, describe this email campaign that U.S. intelligence attributed to Iran. What was the content of the emails and who were they sent to?
So the messages varied little. It was a series of template-style emails that pretended to come from an account linked to the Proud Boys and basically said to the reader, look, we know who you are. We know you're a registered Democrat. We have all this information about you. And we also know how you vote. So watch out and make sure to vote for Donald Trump. People who were registered to vote in a couple of different places, notably Florida, got a lot of these emails. And some of the emails just had this message. A fraction of them also included some snippets of data, like people's addresses. And then some of the other emails also included a link to a video, which purported to show evidence of other kinds of election hacking. The video was very much fraudulent. So the emails weren't saying something that was true, but they were absolutely alarming.
So I said these emails were sent to American voters. How might Iran have gotten, or other foreign actors, gotten a U.S. voter information?
Many people may not be familiar with the fact that a lot of states do provide some degree of voter information publicly for the asking, either via a website or some other process. So it's not inherently difficult to get information about who's registered to vote for what party. That said, and this is really, I think, an open question right now, are those websites the source for the information that Iran was using? Or did Iran get information that might have included other non-public categories of information, like email addresses, from some other mechanism? Which brings me to this important point, which is it's remarkable how fast the intelligence community and the FBI came forward with this attribution to Iran. I've never seen anything like it. But learning from the lessons from 2016, I think the next hope is that they match that speed of attribution with a speed of transparency.
At an even more basic level, can we know for sure that this was, in fact, the Iranian government and not some rogue imposters? I mean, do you trust the U.S. intelligence attribution to Iran?
From my perspective, I think that there are definite signs that this was a nation-state operation, maybe not the A-team of a nation-state operation. The challenge with this case is that some of the techniques that were used to send the messages looked like the toolkit of spammers, right? Except instead of marketing a product, they were trying to sell people on an idea and some fear. And I think that people pointed out, well, there was nothing about this that was so sophisticated that it only reflects the rarefied skill set of a bunch of nation-state hackers. But we also know from experience that there are plenty of ways that nation states work in the cyber realm, and it doesn't always involve using their most sophisticated tools. One interesting observation here is it certainly seems like the people who did this expected to be noticed. They wanted this to be noticed and were trying to achieve a result. And if you do that, maybe you don't want to use your most sophisticated tools because that would very quickly point to a nation state. But again, that's speculation.
So with 12 days away from the big vote, what is your assessment today, John, of U.S. preparedness when it comes to election security and Washington's ability to respond to influence campaigns and other threats?
Boy, I think that that is, as I like to say, an empirical question. We don't really know. But I think that the rapid movement here was a very good sign. I think, though, that a lot of people, myself included, are waiting to see more transparency, more evidence that suggests that next time around, even though this was rapid movement, the response will be more proactive rather than reactive. I also think, you know, we're talking about messing with the election here. I think when COVID vaccination time comes, that's going to be a big target for this kind of thing. And I'm just desperately concerned that we haven't figured out as a society how to quickly make ourselves immune, if you forgive the analogy, to this kind of disinformation.
John Scott Railton, senior researcher at the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto. Thanks very much for breaking this down for us.
Thanks, Marco. Those were great questions.
For 2 weeks, massive protests against police brutality have ricocheted across Nigeria. It's brought thousands of people into the streets. But this week, things turned deadly in the country's biggest city, Lagos. Amnesty International says Nigerian police and military shot and killed at least 12 protesters. People around the world have condemned the killings, especially Nigerians living abroad. The World's Halima Gikandi has more.
Le Palanca restaurant in Nairobi specializes in Nigerian cuisine. I came here to meet one of their chefs, Samson Oluwase Fariola. He's from Nigeria. He was supposed to have the day off, but he wanted to come meet with me to talk about what's happening in his home country.
At first, when I watched the news like 2 nights ago, I couldn't sleep.
He's referring to the violent crackdown on peaceful protesters in Lagos on Tuesday. Human rights organizations and eyewitnesses accuse Nigerian security forces of opening fire on protesters. Nigeria's army has denied those allegations, but graphic videos on social media tell a gruesome story. Fariola says those videos keep him up at night.
Seeing them shooting our youth just because they demanded for a kind of reformation in the Nigerian system, and the next action we got was to start shooting at us. Ah, I felt so bad.
The peaceful protest began against SARS. That's a notorious special anti-robbery police squad in Nigeria. For years, they've been accused of human rights violations, including torture. Nigeria's government said last week it would dismantle the unit, but protests continued nonetheless. Because, as Fariola says, SARS is only one part of the problem.
Even police officers in Nigeria, I hate them with passion because they extort you. You have to bribe your way out.
He says he's had to pay bribes to the police just for driving, even when he's had the correct paperwork. Fariola left Nigeria about a year ago because, along with police corruption, there weren't any jobs. Nigeria is rich in oil and other resources, but unemployment is sky high.
I would never have thought of leaving my country if my country was a better place for me to live. I would have stayed back in my country. I would have really stayed back, yeah.
Many Nigerians have left their country searching for greener pastures. It's a huge diaspora across the world, and they've made their voices heard during these protests.
We want people in Nigeria to know that just because we're not there doesn't mean that we don't care. And that's an important message to send.
That's Nkuleka Onye. She was born in the U.S., and her parents are immigrants from Nigeria. She's a high school principal in Rhode Island, but she often travels back and forth to Nigeria. Over the weekend, she joined other Nigerian Americans to demonstrate in front of the State House in Providence. They held signs that read, End SARS. That's the hashtag protesters in Nigeria have adopted. Onye says they'll be holding another protest this coming weekend. There have already been protests across the world, in London, Washington, D.C., and Accra. Onye thinks there's one thing that has inspired Nigerians to go out to the streets, and that's the Black Lives Matter movement. She says what happened to George Floyd over the summer resonated with so many people.
And we really think that what has inspired the rally and the protests in Nigeria, the young people to organize and begin to speak out, is really what they've seen in the United States and around the world.
She says injustice in Nigeria isn't just an African problem. It's a global problem requiring a global response. That's why Nkoleka Onye says she's writing to her local officials in Rhode Island. And next, she plans to call the United Nations. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
Some other big news just days away from the general election. The Trump administration is expanding the expedited removal of undocumented immigrants, basically giving sharper teeth to a 2019 rule. That rule allows federal agents to deport immigrants within 100 miles of an international border under certain conditions. The new policy will apply to undocumented immigrants apprehended anywhere in the U.S. Anand Balakrishnan is a staff attorney at the ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project. There was concern the White House was going to aggressively push this through. How big of a change is this new policy, Anand?
It does mark a drastic change from the course of immigration law over the past two decades, during which time there was a general bipartisan consensus that the use of expedited removal, which is a system that allows people to be deported without bringing them first before an immigration judge for a fair hearing, should be limited to the borders or to people who had only very recently entered. The rule last year had expanded it, as you mentioned, to cover the entirety of the United States and allow for the deportation without a hearing of someone who can't demonstrate that they've been in the country continuously for 2 years prior to the moment of their arrest. It's a dramatic change, and it's one that is fundamentally flawed. On the practical side, because there's no neutral adjudicator who can ensure that a removal is accurate or fair, it's been rife with error. And the expansion of expedited removal will no doubt cause even more problems to ensue. And from a fundamental legal perspective, you know, all non-citizens in the country are accorded due process rights. And those rights entitle them to a fair hearing, just as anyone else has. If they have, say, even like a car taken away from them by the government, they get more protections than expedited removal provides them.
So now when an immigrant is apprehended, what will ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, what will they look at in terms of that person's status to enforce this expedited removal scheme? Can you give us maybe an example of someone who would be impacted by this?
It's still unclear exactly how it will be used on the ground. An individual who would, say, just recently entered the country, say, in the past 6 months, could be deported by an ICE officer simply with a few simple pieces of paper and never see an immigration judge.
In other words, expedited removal would mean an immediate deportation. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct.
What prompted this change, Anand?
In my view, it wasn't prompted by any sort of practical need. The immigration system has worked well and has provided, you know, hearings for people who are in the interior of the country for over a century. And I think that it's best to see this as part and parcel of sort of the attempt to crack down on immigrants' rights that started 4 years ago.
ICE has taken other aggressive steps lately in battleground states, for example, like Pennsylvania. Tell us what happened there.
ICE has been placing billboards with the faces of people who are alleged to be undocumented, who purportedly have committed crimes. I mean, this is something that just shouldn't happen. I mean, the immigration system shouldn't run on fear and hatred in that way. It neither makes communities safer, nor does it advance any sort of rational administration of the immigration law. All it does is sow fear and confusion.
Anand Balakrishnan is a staff attorney at the ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project. Thanks very much for being with us, Anand.
Of course. Thank you.
You're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi gave a televised address this week, urging the public not to let their guard down. India has recorded more than 7.5 million coronavirus cases. Only the U.S. has more. It's also the start of festival season in India. That usually means big crowds celebrating religious holidays. But today, at the start of the five-day Durga Puja festival in Kolkata, things look very different, as Sandeep Roy reports.
Every year, Chandri Chatterjee's extended family descends on her old family home in Kolkata to celebrate Durga Puja. It's the festival of the mother goddess Durga. But this year, they have a strict schedule for family members.
Dividing up the number of days we come so that they're not more than 5 or 6 people at the same time.
Chatterjee's family members pitch in to pay for the five-day festival. But she says these months of pandemic lockdown have hit people's pocketbooks hard.
Not everyone has money to spare. We've just asked people that, you know, whatever you're comfortable with contributing, please go ahead and do it.
This year, the family's Durga idol is only half the usual size. This is true for Durga Pujas across the city. Things will be very different this year, with temperature guns, hand sanitizers, and a strict no mask, no goddess policy. And according to a new court ruling, no visitors inside the temples. Only organizers and priests can enter the temporary temples called pandals. Jaideep Mukherjee promotes Durga Puja as a cultural attraction through his Meghdootam Foundation. This year, his international judges can't come to Kolkata for the annual Best Durga Puja competition. So they're doing it online.
We are going to move to different pandals, take these small videos, share it with them, and we are going to do this award ceremony virtually.
Usually people wait in line for hours to take selfies at the big pandals. We've had Hogwarts pandals, Thai temples, and pandals made out of biscuits. The mother goddess is always shown slaying a buffalo demon, but this year many of the temporary temples show her defeating another enemy, says Mukherjee.
The demon this time is the corona.
Durga Puja theme designer Rintu Das was moved by the images of thousands of migrant laborers earlier this year. They were trudging home across the country when trains stopped running because of the lockdown. Instead of a goddess in resplendent finery, his Durga is a migrant woman with her family made from plain clay. Das says, isn't serving humanity the best way to worship God? Theme designer Anirban Pandalwala designed his temple with a broken wall so that the goddess can be seen from outside. In any case, he says, most pandals will be streaming online. It's really a digital Durga Puja this year. Even the way the goddess is worshipped will change this year. Usually devotees throng the pandal, throwing flower petals at the goddess while drums beat, bells ring, and platters of cut fruits are offered. This year, Malavika Banerjee's family's 110-year-old Durga Puja is going to be different.
Like not serving cut fruit to the deity, and similarly cutting down on the garlands that adorn the goddess.
And restricting the audience.
Critically, we are all discouraging 65-plus members of the family from coming to the puja.
But Durga Puja is not just a religious festival and street art extravaganza. It's also an economic lifeline for tens of thousands of carpenters, electricians, priests, food vendors, painters, and musicians. Some experts reckon that 30% of the state's GDP is somehow linked to this mother of all festivals. It feels like a goddess who vanquishes evil is more important than ever this year, Jaideep Mukherjee got the children in one remote village to make a miniature Durga idol, barely a foot and a half tall. Children from other villages made tiny lamps out of white cork and a bamboo temple. Mukherjee put it all together in a city alleyway.
It is indigenously done by the little hands. It is completely by the children.
Maybe this display of Durga Puja is sending a message that perhaps what really matters during a pandemic is a community coming together. For the world, Sandeep Roy, Kolkata.
Baseball players are getting a day of rest from the World Series. Last night, the Tampa Bay Rays evened up the series 1-1 against the Los Angeles Dodgers. One player in particular has caught our attention this October. Here's the world's Jessica Yarmosky.
For you baseball fans out there, you've been hearing this name a lot during the postseason.
Randy Arozarena making a name for himself in this 2020
Randy
postseason.
Randy Arozarena is having an insane few weeks for the Rays. He's just a rookie and already has 7 home runs in the postseason. That's the all-time record for a rookie. But it's not just his bat that's getting attention. In his 25 years, Arozarena has had a pretty incredible life. He was born and raised in Cuba, but defected to Mexico at the age of 19. A scout saw his potential there. Guillermo Armanta said the first time he saw Arozarena play in the Mexican city of Merida, he knew the young athlete was special. Physically athletic, but also emotionally mature.
He always had adaptation and emotional stability for the great maturity.
He kind of had to have a great maturity. He just traveled by boat from Cuba and knew no one in Mexico. Arozarena joined a training program in Merida and played in front of dozens of scouts. But the young athlete grew frustrated that he didn't seem to be getting noticed.
He told me in Spanish, "Hey, Guillermo, a mí nunca me van a firmar. Maybe I don't have any opportunity for sign."
Armanta jokingly issued a challenge. He said if Arozarena could walk on his hands from home plate to first base, he'd get signed.
And say, "I can do that, Guillermo."
And he did.
Yeah, and I say, "Wow, that kid is incredible, athlete."
Once the tryout was over, Armanta knew that he wanted to sign Arozarena to his own organization, the Tijuana Toros in the Mexican Baseball League. But first, he had to convince Arozarena to move across Mexico to Tijuana.
He said, it's called Tijuana.
But the scout said, you'd better get used to it.
Remember that when you play in October in New York in the World Series, it's cold.
That's all the convincing Randy Arozarena needed. He joined Armanta's team in Tijuana, which launched him into the major leagues and into the record books. Arozarena is far from the first Cuban athlete in the major leagues, but it's not easy for them to get there. Cuban athletes have long had to escape their country in order to be recruited by major league teams. And this opened up opportunities for traffickers and smugglers to exploit them. President Obama tried to soften the U.S.-Cuba relationship and allowed Cuban players to be signed directly to American teams. But President Trump reversed that rule last year. Armanta says scouts are used to this obstacle, and there are still plenty of chances for Cuban players to be seen by scouts in tournaments and at workouts. One other point about Randy Arozarena, he doesn't see Cuba as home anymore.
Randy is Mexican in this moment.
Mexico took him in. Mexico is where his daughter now lives. And Mexico is the country that launched his professional career. Fans across Mexico and Cuba will assuredly be watching tomorrow night when Game 3 of the World Series picks up. For The World, I'm Jessica Yarmosky.
You're with The World. Talking politics these days is tough at a lot of dinner tables. Consider the generation gap among Vietnamese Americans.
It's gotten to the point where people of the younger generation have had to form support groups with each other in order to try to figure out how to cope with the stresses of this generational and political problem.
45 years of division coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. If there's one institution that could help the global economy recover from the impact of COVID-19, it's the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. Around 100 countries have asked the IMF for emergency assistance, and the organization has taken unprecedented action, loaning out close to $100 billion. But there may be some worrisome strings attached. Here's The World's Rupa Shenoy.
The International Monetary Fund was built to step in and stabilize global markets just at a moment like this, the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. And early in the pandemic, the IMF poured money into countries with few conditions attached. This is IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva.
The IMF has been very loud and clear in this crisis, turning to our membership, and we say, spend, but keep the receipts.
Those initial loans were a lifeline for some countries in freefall. But as the crisis lingered, many needed more money, like Costa Rica, and had to request another loan. And this time, the IMF asked that, in exchange, Costa Rica increase taxes and sell some state assets. The country's labor unions balked. Earlier this month, protesters took to the streets for weeks.
The protests were so huge that the government had to cancel this proposal.
Patricia Miranda is director of advocacy at Latindad, the Latin American Network for Social and Economic Rights. She says there's a simple way for the IMF board to just give struggling countries access to money they never have to pay back. It's done that in the past during hard economic times. But the U.S. has veto power on the IMF board, and the Trump administration has used it to shut down that option for now. So the IMF is supporting countries through loans.
And that is mostly a global policy out of our hands. They are just postponing the problem for a couple of years, but they're not getting the problem solved.
Miranda says Latin America has little say in its situation and is already sliding backwards into a deep economic hole it took decades to work itself out of. That's why her organization and 500 others across the globe signed on to a joint letter. It urges the IMF to abandon the belt-tightening policies it has historically imposed on countries after an economic crisis. Nadia Dar is director of Oxfam International's Washington, D.C. office.
People are not going to get jobs immediately. So it's very important that governments still have the capacity and the space, and they have the time to address this economic crisis in a way that is going to help people and not increase inequality further.
Many countries are struggling now because they're still recovering from colonialism, says Bhumika Muchala, senior policy researcher at the Third World Network. She says if the IMF insists on austerity measures, it will be another case of countries in the global north imposing their beliefs on those in the global south.
They promote austerity to ensure that creditors are repaid, but also that debt levels remain quote unquote sustainable. So meaning debt levels remain low so that creditors, bankers, are not going to be freaked out. And so what matters is to keep the debt levels low, even at the expense of meeting health and recovery needs in these countries.
Muchala says the stability of markets shouldn't be prioritized over human rights. The best solution, she says, would be if lenders canceled countries' debt. And IMF staff agree with her. IMF Communications Director Jerry Rice says they're advocating for that to happen. Meanwhile, he says the IMF knows it has to be cautious about when to call for belt tightening for countries receiving loans.
At some point, and I think all countries recognize this, it's not just the IMF, there will be a need to restore public finances. But the emphasis, at least as far as the IMF is concerned, will be on protecting the vulnerable.
Rice says repeatedly, this is not the old IMF. It's acting in an unprecedented way.
Everybody is anxious right now because we're facing the biggest crisis of our lifetimes. And I can tell you that, you know, the big message from our annual meetings that just concluded was do not withdraw support too early. Do not withdraw support prematurely. That is what we see as the biggest risk right now.
And in the countries that are struggling, activists want to be clear that they're not asking for a handout. Shireen Talat is co-director of the Arab Watch Regional Coalition. She's based in Morocco, where she says the pandemic has people struggling to fulfill their basic needs, and austerity measures would be devastating.
We are not asking for free money. You are doing a lot of investment. You will gain a lot of money from this investment.
She says if people in her region aren't living a decent life as workers or consumers, they won't be able to contribute to a global economy that makes people in places like the U.S. wealthy. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
As long as there have been parents and children, there have been generation gaps, especially when it comes to politics. The Vietnamese-American community knows this, an older generation whose politics were shaped by anti-communist sentiment in the aftermath of the Vietnam War, and their children who are drifting away from their parents' hardline views. We're going to hear from both sides of this generation gap. Pham Do Chi is a retired economics professor at American University. He came to the U.S. in 1970 on a university scholarship. Chi is voting for Donald Trump. Chi, thanks for being with us. It's good to meet you.
Thanks, Marco.
Also with us is Viet Thanh Nguyen. He is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Sympathizer and a professor at the University of Southern California. He was four when his family fled Vietnam. Viet is voting for Joe Biden. Welcome to you, Viet Thanh Nguyen.
Thanks for having me, Marco, and thanks for being here with you, Chi.
Let me start with Chi. Why are you supporting President Trump?
First of all, congratulations, Viet, for winning that prestigious Pulitzer Prize. That is the pride of our Vietnamese community in America. My sincere congratulations to you. However, you raise a big question. Why should I vote for President Trump? You know, I must be honest with you. My son of 36 and my nephew, several of them in the age group of 30 to 40 also asked me questions, but the other way around. Why don't you support Mr. Biden? He presents no policy agenda for the future, no achievement in his political life.
Chi, you said you've got a son who's 36. I ask who he's voting for, or if you have other kids who they're voting for?
The son of 36, he said that he's undecided right now. He said he doesn't like President Trump with his character. However, he has the right policy for the country. And my daughter of 34, she said definitely she doesn't like Trump because as a woman, I don't like Trump.
How does that make you feel? I mean, have you had political discussions in your family and how have they gone?
I had political discussion, but I respect their view because they are a different generation. And this is the drama in most of Vietnamese families in our community right now.
Viet Thanh Nguyen, let me turn to you. You're a Biden supporter. Are these discussions happening in your family? Do you have older members who are voting differently from you?
My father is still alive, and he's 86. I think it's beyond caring about politics right now. But certainly what Chi said, I think, is true. There's a very painful generational and partisan split in the Vietnamese-American community. I hear a lot of this from younger Vietnamese-Americans, and by that I mean people who are probably, you know, in their 40s and younger, down to the college age. And they feel so distressed about it because it's very difficult, obviously, to talk across a partisan divide. But in the Vietnamese-American community and in Vietnamese-American culture, younger people are supposed to respect their elders. And so it's distressing for us to know that we are in conflict with an older generation. And it's gotten to the point where Vietnamese-American people of the younger generation have had to form support groups with each other.
Literally support groups.
Yeah, they started the Viet Solidarity and Action Network on Facebook, as well as the Asian Americans with Republican Parents support group. And these groups have literally thousands of members. And the conversations on these Facebook sites are very much about how can I communicate with my older parents, seem to have views that are so disattached from the political realities and perspectives of a younger generation.
Why are you voting for Biden, Viet?
I do feel that we're living in a political environment right now that is so drastically divided that the choice is very clear. I certainly cannot support Donald Trump for a number of reasons, ranging from personality and politics. And given the gravity of the Trump administration and what it's done to damage and to divide the United States, any alternative is better. And in fact, Joe Biden is actually a very good alternative in terms of offering policies that are sane and also offering up demeanor that is dignified. And like many Biden supporters, I'm hoping that he will restore the United States to a more humane setting.
Chi, how do you think your experience as an immigrant has informed your political views?
Since I live here as an immigrant, I don't see any racial discrimination. I am a student at Wharton School. I earn my life through my scholarship and my work at the same time. And in the last 3.5 years, quite frankly, I think that with the job market, which is good, I see many happy Black Americans, many happy Spanish Americans. For me, fundamentally, for all Americans at this time, the economy is a key dominant feature. And if we get out of this pandemic, maybe the COVID-19 become a history. And at that time, one would wonder who can bring the U.S. back to a fast recovery. And in my mind, it must be President Trump.
Viet Thanh Nguyen, how do you make a case to Chi and other older members of the Vietnamese American community for your political views, or do you even try?
I think Chi is fairly representative of what I've heard from older Vietnamese Americans in terms of his worldviews. And, you know, when it comes to the question of race, for example, I think a lot of younger Vietnamese Americans would really strongly disagree that they have not experienced or witnessed racism in the United States. It's not uncommon to hear, I think, from older Vietnamese and other Asian immigrants this kind of perspective. And it's partly because they have not been raised within the United States, have not been exposed to the history of civil rights and the contributions of Black Americans and other people of color to the political climate of the United States, which created an environment that welcomed Vietnamese refugees to the country. And so one of the ironies of the situation is that it's because of the civil rights movement and the struggle of Black Americans and other peoples of color that have allowed hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese refugees to come here, some of whom would then say, there's no racism here, and we don't want to allow more refugees in because we were the good refugees, and these new immigrants and new refugees are the bad immigrants and bad refugees. I think younger Vietnamese Americans, having benefited from these types of social policies that are pro-immigrant and pro-refugee, are much more inclined to support further immigration, further refugee allotments, and also to point out the ongoing existence of terrible discrimination and racism against peoples of color, especially African Americans. And we find it, I think, very difficult sometimes to speak to an older generation that doesn't want to hear or doesn't understand these perspectives. And so a good number of younger Vietnamese Americans have, I think, basically given up on trying to persuade the older generation.
Chi, can I just ask you this? Did you feel the U.S. gave you a better life? And do you think it's wrong to criticize the country that gave you a better life?
Definitely. And I tell you, I was more adamant than him to be with the socialist cause, with the idealistic views when I was 25, 30. And for me, when I came to the state, President Kennedy was my idol. And various Democratic presidents were my idols until I become a bit more aging. And I realized life is not that simple.
Viet, is there a bridge to this generation gap? And will it get built because you'll be aging?
Well, I certainly can't presume to know how I'm going to feel in 20 or 30 years. I respect Chi's experience here, and I stand humbled before the future. But for me, I think the divisive factor in this is Donald Trump himself. If Donald Trump is reelected, then I don't think there is going to be reconciliation, because reconciliation is not in Donald Trump's vocabulary. And so the deep divisions and exacerbations will continue. And as strongly as I disagree with Chi and other Vietnamese Americans who support Donald Trump, I am very willing to begin the process of rebuilding our relationships with each other.
Viet Thanh Nguyen is a Pulitzer Prize winning writer. His forthcoming novel is The Committed. Pham Do Chi is a retired economics professor at American University. Thank you both very much for your thoughts.
Thank you, Marco, and thank you very much, Viet.
Thank you so much, Marco. Thank you, Chi.
The idea of an art museum is that you get to see original works, the actual brushstrokes of Picasso, for example, not fakes or counterfeits. At a new exhibition at the Museum Ludwig in Cologne, Germany, though, you'll see both the original and a counterfeit side by side. The exhibit is meant to highlight art authentication. Rita Kersting is the museum's deputy director and the curator of the exhibit. She joins us from Cologne. Say I am visiting the Museum Ludwig, walking into this new show. Describe for us some of what we'd see.
You see 25 works from our collection of Russian avant-garde, a movement from 100 years ago, great experimental, innovative paintings. But the problem is that a lot of them were faked. And now, during the last years, we have researched and found paintings that are not authentic, and we present them.
You focus specifically on Russian avant-garde art in the early 20th century because it has some specific problems. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. There are forgeries and fakes, many more fakes than in any other movement. And that has reasons, political reasons, that have to do with the Cold War and with the repression of that movement during Soviet times. So there was not, especially not in the West, much knowledge of the Russian avant-garde movement. So it was quite easy to introduce to the market works that were not authentic.
Why did you put these fakes on display? What did you want visitors to the museum, Ludwig, to understand?
We are a public museum, which means that our paintings belong to the citizens of Cologne. And we all want to know if they were painted by Malevich, by Popova, by Repko and all those other great artists. And if they are not, we want to identify them and not show them on the white walls again as originals. We will nevertheless present them in the database with all necessary information.
How did you go about determining that the counterfeits were not originals?
Our research is based on three pillars. It's provenance, where has it been before Ludwig acquired it? The second is art historical research. And the third is you select particles of paint and canvas and do chemical analysis.
For many years, it was taboo for museums to even kind of take on issues around art authentication and possible fakes in their collections. Why was that?
Until now, like nearly any other museum, we put the fakes into the storage. We don't want to talk about it. It's something that you suppress. And it's difficult to admit that you made mistakes or that the collectors who support you made mistakes. And it's a delicate and sometimes embarrassing issue, but it's important to present the research that you can do and that you need to do when you're not sure about the authenticity.
You mentioned, Rita, the embarrassment caused by counterfeits. So I have to ask, have you ever been had by a forgery?
Yes, there are forgeries that you cannot tell that they are forgeries. They are very well made. And even if you don't do anything else in your life than looking at Russian avant-garde art, you sometimes cannot tell a forgery from an original work. Of course, when a certain work turned out to be not original, it's painful. It's sad. But it's also, we are delighted and pleased that we now know for sure.
Rita Kersting is a deputy director of the Museum Ludwig in Cologne and a curator of their new exhibition, Russian Avant-Garde at the Museum Ludwig Original and Fake. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
The transition to renewable energy is going to take a lot more than simply building more wind turbines and solar panels. Countries also need to find ways to slow down the burning of oil, gas, and coal. Germany has a plan to phase out coal, and that's on the agenda today in our weekly look at climate change solutions, The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
Reporter Dan Guarino has been covering Germany's energy transition for Inside Climate News. Dan, thanks for being with us again. Germany has been one of the most successful countries in transitioning to renewables. Nearly half of its energy comes from renewable sources now. But you write that getting off coal has been one of the most challenging aspects of this transition. Why has it been so hard?
Much like the U.S., Germany has a coal industry that is kind of close to the heart of its culture. Germany grew into a great industrial power and a great economic power, partly because it has the benefit of plentiful coal. So it is very, very difficult to tell an industry you need to stop, you need to phase out. And that's kind of what Germany has been going through.
Right. So before the pandemic, you visited coal country in Germany, a place called Lusatia, to learn more about the transition. What did you learn when you went there?
I found these beautiful villages. And it wasn't until I actually got in a van with my tour guide that I realized I was right around all of these open pit coal mines. There are these gigantic surface mines taking up dozens upon dozens of football fields worth of land, but they're kind of hidden in a lot of ways. It's like this kind of picturesque series of villages with heavy industry just right on its doorstep. Another big thing that you notice in Lusatia is that there are these lakes everywhere, and the lakes are former surface mines. This is a region where they filled in former surface mines and turned them into this kind of lake recreation area. my guide for the portion of the trip where I was looking at the coal mines and the lakes was Soren Hoika.
These old mines were now transformed over the last 30 years into a beautiful lakeland where you can do tours, where you can go by bike or where you can go swimming or by boat.
There are 4 mines remaining, and they're just gigantic, and they're still expanding. The mining industry is still a major employer, and surface mining is still a very active part of day-to-day life in this part of Germany.
Germany has said they want to close their last coal plants by 2038 and will spend nearly $50 billion in that effort. What are they spending that money on? Is it like offsetting lost jobs?
The biggest chunk of that money is what I would describe as local economic development. Finding ways to improve infrastructure, you know, like roads, train lines, and also finding ways to attract new industries and new jobs. A typical example might be a university in one of these areas having a program of grants to encourage entrepreneurs to set up new businesses in new industries in the region. They're basically trying a whole bunch of different things, knowing that some are going to work and some might not work, to try to find what that new economy looks like when coal is no longer there.
You spoke with a member of Germany's coal commission, Felix Mathis, who is kind of takes the 10,000-foot view, says getting off coal requires the government to think about more than just coal.
Coal phase-out is a part of a bigger picture and a bigger project. You need to have a holistic approach because every phase-out is not only the story about the phase-out, it's about the story of phase-in.
Dan, explain that. What does he mean by phase-in?
This is the lesson for the United States and for other countries going through transitions. You don't just convince an industry or a region to walk away from a big industry. The way to make this kind of change palatable and workable is to say that this is a change to something else that could be good, something else that for some people could be better, and emphasizing the phase in. And saying, here are the details of what we're really going to do, backed by real money, not just talk. And if the conversation is a little bit about the phase out, but largely about the phase in, it changes the politics. It just changes the dynamics of the whole thing. And I think that that's the big thing I learned from looking at how Germany has done its coal phase out.
Dan Guarino is an energy reporter. He's been covering Germany's energy transition for Inside Climate News. Dan, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
You can read Dan's story on Germany's plan to quit coal at theworld.org. When it comes to climate change solutions, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about how to solve this global crisis? We'll try and answer them here on the show. Email us at climate@theworld.org. Okay, in this pandemic, here's something I know you don't want to think about, but imagine you end up in the hospital with COVID-19. You're sick in bed, you're scared, and a doctor comes in to check on you. He's in full protective gear, face shield, the works. Then he busts a move. Dr. Arup Senapoti, an ENT surgeon in Assam, India, is making the world a happier place. He was filmed dancing to the Bollywood track Gungaroo just to cheer up his COVID patients. Dr. Senapoti nails the signature hook step popularized by Bollywood actor Hrithik Roshan. The good doctor also channels some old school Michael Jackson. The video, of course, went viral. Even actor Hrithik Roshan himself tweeted about it. Tell Dr. Arup I'm going to learn his steps and dance as good as him someday. You know what they used to say? Ginger Rogers did everything that Fred Astaire did. She just did it backwards and in high heels. Well, Dr. Senapoti did everything Hrithik Roshan did. He just did it in a face shield and with shoe covers. You gotta check out the video. It'll give you a smile. The doctor might even get a little bit too out of control. You'll see what I mean. You can see the dancing doctor at theworld.org. Yeah. And that's where we leave things today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston at GBH, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.